This is Jenny Garth from 90210 OMG. Let's be honest. The 90s gave us some great things. The music, totally rad. The fashion, so fly. Home decor, that's a different story. In HGTV's new competition series, Totally 90s House, two teams of iconic TV stars take on two homes frozen in time. Paired with HGTV experts, they'll turn dated spaces into fresh, modern homes and compete for the ultimate bragging rights. Goodbye, honeyoak cabinets. Hello, 21st century style. Totally 90s House special series premiere starts August 26th at 9, 8 Central on HGTV.
Hi.
Whatever.
Hello, everybody. This is Again With This, Dawson's Creek. Today's episode is Season 6, Episode 12, All the Right Moves. And now here are your hosts,
Tara Aranio and Sarah D. Bunting.
Hello, Sarah.
Hello.
Hello, listeners, and hello to one very special listener, because before we get into what's coming to the Patreon, we have a message for Emily. Your husband, Kyle, wanted us to wish you a very happy birthday, and we want to do that. And also, thank you so much for your support all of these years.
We are told by your esteemed spouse that you hang out with us while doing household chores, and as someone who can only get through certain tasks with the aid of beloved podcasts, we acknowledge this as the great honor it is, and thank you.
We really do. Have an excellent day, and thanks again for listening. Happy birthday, Emily! Thank you, Dave, for getting in on this. Having done that, we also want to tell you this Friday, August 28th, we're going to bring you again with this 301. Let's watch Ken Marino in Wet Hot American Summer. It is obviously the end of summer. It is the last day of camp in our lives and also in this movie. So it's time to talk about it. You can rent or purchase it on Amazon or Apple TV. We'll link that in the show notes. And if you want to hear us talk about that, go to againwiththispodcast.com/club. Sarah, shall we get into this episode?
Yes, we shall.
All right, let's start with our C plot so we can get through it and leave it there. Pacey might be nearly approaching the verge of understanding that Rinaldi sucks, or maybe not. We join Pacey at a brokerage staff meeting, clip two.
I'd like to remind you to keep pushing Stepatec Industries. It's about to shoot through the roof. When the new drug gets approved on Monday, anyone who holds the stock is going to be very, very rich. And I don't need to remind you that Stepatec itself is a client here, and we'd like to keep them happy, so keep giving it the hard sell.
Okay, I know this is just business, but isn't that what Martha Stewart got in trouble for? I won't pretend to understand any part of this world.
I mean, basically, like, the parts of the non-boiler room financial institution that had institutional clients would have no contact with the parts that were in sales, retail sales of equities.
That's what I thought.
And this is also insider trading, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Unclear. Anyway, yeah, Rinaldi's a scumbag. We get it.
Mm-hmm. There's no explanation of that part of this in this episode at all.
No, this is absolutely stocks. Like,
yeah,
whatever.
We'll get to it. But I think it's laying the groundwork for, like, oh, he's been doing shady shit all this time. And Pacey was just too ignorant to know. But it's like, if he passed his exam, I would think he learned some of that stuff.
Yeah. But if he passed his exam, he would not have to work here anymore.
Right.
So, yeah.
Anyway, Rinaldi asks Pacey to hang back so he can say that despite their clashes in the past, he won't let Pacey's great work go unrewarded. The huge commissions are reward enough for Pacey, but Rinaldi has another motivator, which is an invitation to a party at the home of Roger Stepovich, the founder of Stepatec. Roger told Rinaldi to bring his bestseller, which puts Rinaldi in a tough spot because that's definitely Pacey, and Rinaldi hasn't forgotten Pacey coming at him on the street in the actual French Quarter or faking sick to blow off work. But Pacey is 100% committed to this job, and he will be honored to attend the party. And what effect any of this had on Emma or the events of the previous episode do not come up, so don't even ask. Never mind.
Yeah. Also, is this Stepakov trying to insert himself into this, or is he gone by now?
No, he's still there. I think this is just a cute inside joke. Mm-hmm. The next time we see Pacey, Rinaldi's walking him into said party, hyping up that this is the big leagues, etc. And after introducing Pacey to some Stepatech executive, he takes off to network, leaving Pacey unattended so that a character credited as Mystery Girl, played by the great Sarah Shahi, now seen in Paradise, can pin Pacey down and order him to pretend they're having a conversation so that she can escape the 98-year-old who keeps grabbing her ass. When Pacey introduces himself, she already knows all about his boy wonder reputation, but no, she does not work for Stepatech. When she brings up his connection to Rinaldi, Pacey tries to follow that thread to her identity to no avail. She asks what drew him to this work instead of to a college education. It was the money initially, but now it's the adrenaline rush of selling. He tries asking what she does, but she sees that the old guy has wandered off and abandons Pacey immediately. When he calls after her that he doesn't even know her name, she flirts that he'll have to try a little harder than that. And later, Pacey's still trying to figure out who Mystery Girl is. Rinaldi can't tell from the back of her head, but never mind. It's time for him to bring Pacey back to Stepovich's private office. And over cigars, Stepovich, Ray Wise, our fourth Twin Peaks alumnus on the show, says he has heard a lot about Pacey's raw talent. Pacey credits Rinaldi for his rise. Stepovich asks what Pacey thought when Rinaldi told him about taking a more prominent role handling Stepatech. Rinaldi had not actually told him yet, but clip three.
It's like a promotion, Pacey. Your title will stay the same, but you will be getting a substantial raise. And from now on, your name will be on all transactions that we handle for Stepatech Corporate.
That's fantastic.
Is it? Because
pretty sure it isn't. Pretty sure Sarah Shahi is some kind of undercover SEC agent.
Maybe. Yes, it does seem like they're about to do some kind of shady shit and make Pacey officially responsible for it, which Pacey seems to sense at the very back of his mind, because his first reaction is to say he doesn't think he's ready for that. Clip four.
I thought that you said that...
Actually, I'm a little surprised by your attitude, Pacey.
I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. I think I misspoke. It's just such a fantastic opportunity for a man as young as myself. It got me a little flat-footed, but let it never be said that Pacey J. Witter is not all about stepping into the future, which, if I'm correct, is actually the slogan for your fine company.
That'll do.
Excellent. Well, welcome aboard, young man. I predict great things for you in the future.
Well, thank you, sir, and I hope that I can live up to your expectations.
I have no doubt that you will.
Fall guy.
Yeah, it's all not great. Sometime later, Pacey's out front waiting for his car when Mystery Girl joins him. He is still trying to flirt her identity out of her, but she just wants to talk about having seen Rinaldi bring him into Stepovich's private office, guessing that Pacey is up for a promotion and a big raise, and he should maybe just ask himself if it might all be too good to be true. And spoiler, but the fact that this character is credited in two more episodes after this tells us there's more to this than we have seen today, but that's all we get for the moment. On to the B-plot. Harley tries to involve Joey in her scheme to recover Eddie. At Hell's Kitchen, Joey joins Emma to find out why she has seemingly zoned out. It's because she's fantasizing about having sex with the new bartender in the alley out back by the garbage bins, which, like, dream big? At least the back office, maybe a bathroom
stall? Seriously, a piece of furniture? Okay.
Wow, an aristocrat. Joey says for her, it's on the pool table. When Emma is scandalized, Joey says that beneath her prim exterior, she's less prim. It's literally what she says. Speaking of bartenders with hot asses, Emma wonders whatever happened to Eddie. Joey seizes up and then shrugs that he got fired. Emma says he hasn't even been back to clean out his locker. Joey plays dumb about why she would know where he went. Their fling was over before it started. In that case, could Joey clear out his locker? Emma would do it, but she wants to cut out early for band practice. We'll get to it. Joey accepts, nicely setting Emma up for this. Clip 5.
I guess he can pretty much just throw everything into the garbage. If there's anything of any worth, I'm sure he would have come back for us already.
I don't get it.
Emma. Emma.
Well, I don't think she meant it like that, but that is how I heard it. So, with one last lustful ogling of the new guy's butt, which you can see in the visual aids, Emma is out. And when we see Joey next, she is cleaning out Eddie's locker, managing to let one of his flannels pass through her hands and to the trash without sniffing it. So credit for at least leaving one cliche left out of this episode.
Yes, thank you.
When she gets deeper into the locker, she finds a fat envelope from Paradigm Publishing, a rejection letter that invites Eddie to send future work on top of a manuscript for a short story collection called Greetings from Worcester. Maybe one of their notes would be kind of a first thought title, but regardless, Joey is shook. And then it's time for one of Joey's Harley hangouts. They're in Joey's dorm room working on Harley's math homework. When Joey gets up for drinks from the mini fridge, Harley asks how Joey's holding up. Joey pretends not to know what she's talking about, but Harley offers to be her confidant. Joey denies that there's anything to discuss, which Harley can't believe. Clip 6.
The boy just disappeared with no explanation. He broke your heart. You're dying inside, wanting to know what happened to him. Thanks for the recap.
Leave it to the pros.
Yeah.
Harley says she might be young, but she knows what Joey's going through more than Joey might think. They're friends, aren't they? Joey guesses they are. So Harley immediately asks how the search for Eddie is going. Joey says it's not like she's going to hire a PI to find a guy she dated for 2 months who obviously never wants to see her again. A, you're right, he doesn't. B, dated is a very strong word for what they did, but Harley says Eddie might have head bonk amnesia or worse. Joey has to be your own detective. Joey admits that she did find a manuscript with his parents' address on it, but she feels weird about calling there. Harley convinces her it's not pathetic, it's romantic and heartfelt, so Joey calls and none other than Eddie himself picks up. So Joey hangs up and Eddie seems completely unconcerned and goes back to fixing his car without a care in the world. So again, underlining, he does not care to see her again. At Hell's Kitchen, a different day, Joey has Eddie's manuscript spread out all over the bar, title page up, the better to broadcast his business to all of his former colleagues. Hetson bursts in and breathlessly asks her where Harley is, yelling Harley's name into the bar. Joey says she's not there, but Hetson says Joey doesn't have to cover for her. The school called and Harley cut for the fourth time this month. Where does Joey think she went? She thinks Harley's okay, right? And under duress, Hetson admits he hasn't been the most present parent, but Harley just went so quickly from Barney and Elmo to possible juvenile delinquent. Joey tries to settle him down, saying that's a front, and he has just moped that his little girl is missing when the little girl herself chirps up behind him, calling him daddy, gives her a huge hug, demanding to know where she was, but she was just running an errand in Worcester. Pan over to Eddie, who has walked in behind Harley and shares a very long, very blank mutual glare with Joey. And when we rejoin them later, Joey is passive-aggressively bustling around Eddie, forcing him to ask if they can go talk somewhere. She is predictably snitty, and as Eddie follows her to the bar, Hetson interrupts with a smeared napkin tucked into his collar to give his compliments to the chef on the wings tonight. Making own fun, we have to respect it.
Yes, we do.
This guy sucks.
Uh-huh.
Joey asks if he should not be home punishing Harley, but he says he is by making her have dinner with him. Also, they're out of root beer. When Joey stalks off, Hetson manages to thank Eddie for driving Harley back, but the next time she comes to visit him in the gutter, he should slither off and stay there, and then he hurries away before Eddie can punch him again, presumably.
Oh my God, it's Worcester, not East New York. Settle down, everyone.
So Eddie gets in Joey's path instead to force her to listen to him as he sincerely tells her he knows and he's here to help her deal with this because it's his problem too. Because Harley told him about her pregnancy. Joey exhaustedly says Harley invented a pregnancy to lure him there, and if she had been pregnant, she certainly would not have told Harley. When she grabs a tray, she sends a page of his manuscript flying, confirming when he asks that it's one of the many worthless things he left behind for other people to clean up. He jumps to the conclusion that finding it is what made Joey send Harley to trick him back, to which Joey spits that if he wanted to stay hidden, he should have covered his tracks better. Clip 7.
Did you call my house and hang up yesterday?
No.
Wow, you know, I mean, it makes sense. You know, I was pissed off about the way things ended between us.
Oh, you see, you know what? That's where you're wrong. Because things actually never really ended between us, Eddie. You just up and moved to Worcester for no apparent reason without even informing me. Which to me, if you ask me, that's not really an ending now, is it?
I don't care. I mean, now that I know you're alive and mystery solved, you can go.
Joey, I left. But did you ever stop to think that maybe I did that for you?
Are you dying, Eddie?
No.
Were you protecting government secrets? Were you kidnapped by international jewel thieves? Is that it? Because otherwise, the only person you did that for was yourself. It was a nice easy out. I get it. You know what? You got it. You're out.
God, you think it was that easy? It was the hardest thing I've ever done.
You've had a good life then.
Well, then stick the fucking landing. Her? Come on.
Yeah. It would be easy for me to ditch her.
Yeah.
Personally. Eddie snaps that they've got nothing left to talk about and he stomps out, but Joey follows him and then has to endure another version of her prom breakup with Pacey. Eddie was too ashamed to say to her face that he couldn't find another job, so he lost his apartment and had his electricity shut off. By the way, in like 2 weeks, like presumably he would still have last month's rent on the books to stay there slightly longer, but whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Joey bleats that she's poor too, just like him. And Eddie says that unlike him, she has a future. He punched Hetz in that time because he was right. Why is Joey the only one who can't see that Eddie is nothing? A guy with no job, savings, prospects, education, or talents. He's even got the rejection letter to prove it. Sure, it says he has promise, but they say that to everyone, which, you know, not to take Joey's side, but they don't. There are nice passes and mean ones. Mm-hmm. Or just, you know, not encouraging ones. So Joey says, in his case, it's true. Clip 8.
I mean, you and I, we're headed for two very different futures. And the truth is, Joe, is you deserve to be with the best guy in the room. Not the one who picks up his trash or busses his table. You're gonna have whatever you want in this life, Joey.
I wanted you.
No. No, you wanted that guy you met in English class. And I'm not him.
I mean, go ahead.
You are.
Yeah.
Like, she is attracted to this, like, I don't know, defensive asshole. So go with it. Mm-hmm. I really think the show just oversubscribes the idea that a boy in late adolescence is going to talk a girl that he loves and wants to fuck out of him. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's a thing.
Yeah.
Like, not that he wouldn't be insecure about it. I just don't think it manifests in this way. It's so exhausting. It was stupid the first time, and it's 2 seasons later, and she is so much worse now.
It's true. Ugh. But yeah, I agree. Like, the guy in her class is the most him he is. You know? Like, just because he wasn't registered doesn't mean he wasn't learning and having insights and reading the books and whatever.
And bugging Hetson, which I'm sure was a big part of the attraction.
Yeah.
Agreed.
True. Regardless, Eddie says he has to go and drives off in some different truck, not the Jeep or whatever we've seen him driving all season. And back inside later, as Joey busses her table, Harley guesses that Joey is mad at her. Harley just wanted to help. Joey asks her to get consent the next time she plans to tell somebody that Joey is fake pregnant. Harley asks what happened, and instead of keeping her moderately grown-up business away from this child and telling one of her age-appropriate friends about it, Joey plops down and recaps their whole fight, which, leave it to the pros, like we said before. As soon as Harley hears about Eddie's manuscript, she gasps that Joey can give it to Hetson for feedback and for him to pass it on to his publishing connections. For some reason, Joey lets herself be convinced that it's a good idea. Before accepting the pages, Hetson makes sure Joey knows he is honest to the point of brutality and has crushed the ambitions of more than one aspiring Sylvia Plath. But Joey says they're not her ambitions, and when Hetson sees Eddie's name on the title page, he turns her down immediately, taking a million words to remind her that Eddie not only stole education from Worthington, he also punched Hetson in the face, so absolutely not. Joey somehow is agog that this is his reaction, and Hetson leaves. When Harley follows, she takes the manuscript from Joey and promises to work on Hetson. Joey reminds her not to leave her bag, and Harley shushes her, because, oh good, she has another scheme cooking. And the scheme is, of course, to send Hetson back to the bar to get her bag after she has nagged him into reading a couple of Eddie's stories and agreed with Joey that they show potential. Clip 9.
Maybe you could show his stories to a publisher.
He's not ready for that.
Well, maybe you could pull some strings at Worthington.
No.
Come on, there's got to be something you can do, anything.
All right, there is someone I know who teaches at the California Writers Workshop.
Are you serious? You think you could get him in?
I think Eddie could get Eddie in, with my recommendation.
Well, isn't that place kind of, like, prestigious?
Kind of like, uh-huh.
He doesn't even have an undergrad degree.
Yeah, no, I know. I still think he's got a shot. Let me know what he says.
Oh, yeah, well, you know what? Actually, Professor Hetson, I think he'd rather hear it from you.
Joey, the kid punched me. I'll try and get him into this program, but I kind of think that that's enough.
Yeah, but see, Professor Hetson, the thing is, he's kind of given up, and I don't think he'd listen to me. We're not on the best of terms.
It's a fascinating saga. Tell you what, it's up to you. You want to try and convince him, tell him I'll write a recommendation, but either way, it's up to you. Ball's in your court, kid. Look, I'm off. I've got Harley chained to a radiator. Gosh, kidding, Joey. Get a sense of humor.
Yeah, good luck with that.
I wish.
Yeah.
This is Jody Sweetin.
And this is Andrea Barber from How Rude, Tanneritos.
HGTV is bringing back the 90s in a big way with Totally 90s House, a brand new renovation competition series that reunites some of your favorite television stars from the era for a showdown unlike anything you've seen before.
Ooh, the 90s gave us so many great things. The music? Totally rad. The fashion? So fly.
But the home design choices? Well, that's a different story. Hosted by Jaleel White, this throwback competition sends two teams of your favorite 90s TV stars across America in search of homes frozen in time. Their mission? Find the two most dated houses they can and transform them into modern dream homes. I'm super excited to be on a team with Beverly Mitchell and Brian Austin Green to team up against Matthew and Joey Lawrence, Melissa Joan Hart, and Keisha Knight Pulliam.
Paired with HGTV mentors, the teams will transform those outdated spaces into fresh, modern homes while keeping just the right amount of nostalgic charm.
Goodbye, honey oak cabinets, sponge-painted walls, and glass blocks. Hello, 21st century dream homes. Totally 90s House, special series premiere, starts August 26th at 9, 8 central on HGTV.
When we see Joey next, she is carrying the manuscript past the truck we saw Eddie driving earlier and then hesitating before she walks up to Eddie's parents' front door. Eddie answers, and she thrusts the manuscript at him, saying it doesn't belong in the garbage, adding that she gave it to Hetson to read and repeats what he said about the workshop. Eddie instantly says he can't afford to go there, and Joey whines that there are scholarships and financial aid. He has to try. It's one thing for him to be a coward about their relationship, but it's another to give up on his own dreams. She starts to leave and then turns back to remind him that he told her he wanted to be the kind of person who took chances and lived life, but as far as she can see, he's afraid of doing that. And he agrees. Clip 10.
So now what? What are you going to do about it? Are you just going to sit here and rot away in Worcester?
Okay.
It's Worcester! Oh my God! It's not a fucking prison ship!
Yeah, did one of the show's writers, like, get mugged there or something? Because they really are acting like it's the worst place on earth.
Oh, my God. Like, it would have helped me out if, like, bullets had been whizzing by during this conversation. Or they're, like, mm-hmm. I don't know, crouched behind a burning barrel in an empty lot or something. But no.
Yeah.
It's Worcester. It's not that bad.
No.
Probably. If you're from there and you're like, no, it's terrible. I moved to Providence immediately.
Sure.
Fine, but mm-hmm. Oh my God.
Eddie takes a beat to let Joey stare at him, and then he darts forward to kiss her. She stops him after a few seconds. He's just doing what she told him to, he said. That's not what she meant. It's too late for that. She smiles sadly and leaves anyway. Clip 11.
Wait, Joey, wait. I love you. Please, Joey, don't go. I don't want it to be too late.
I love you too.
What?
What?
Why? Why?
Why, I mean, either of you? Honestly.
Yeah. Like, it's so weird. It's like they're in different, like they're on different sets. Like, it's not that they have bad chemistry. There's just nothing. Like, each one of them individually is sort of selling their individual lines. But then it's like, I don't know, faces resting on each other. It's just so inert.
Yeah. She smiles sadly, but then leaves anyway, so it is too late, I guess. And for someone who was mad about how Eddie disappeared from her life, Joey is not being much clearer.
No.
In whatever's going on here, and watching her go is the worst he has looked on the show, by the way, so good job, I guess.
Yeah, given how long they dicked around with whatever was or was not between her and Dawson, I guess this isn't a surprise, but like, Oliver Hudson is not uncute. They just clearly have absolutely no idea what they're doing with the season. And the ways that they're choosing to stall are so divorced from how life is actually lived by anyone. It's just crazy.
Yep. Well, that's all we get of it for now. Finally, we have our A plot. Audrey has a rough return to Boston. Everyone except Dawson, who is once again not in this episode at all, is having a grand old time hanging out at Hell's Kitchen. They are probably gearing up to have a tough conversation with Jen about her terrible new haircut
because
the bangs, they are too short.
Also, the rest, which is, it looks like a velodrome helmet made of hair.
I don't mind the bob part. I think she has a face that can carry it off, but the bangs are for no one. They're not acceptable.
Like, if you're going to shoot her from behind, iron the back.
Yes.
It looks like she cut it herself.
It does.
She might have. Good for her, I guess.
I hope not. Anyway, fortunately, Jen is rescued from this fearless feedback by Audrey, shambling up to the table, looking ashamed, but not as nearly as unhealthy as she was when we saw her in the previous episode with Jack Osborne looking like shit. She pretty quickly gets everyone's attention and clip 12.
I messed up, and I'm really sorry. You know, for my insane behavior the past couple of months, for any pain or worry I might have caused you guys, for pushing you away when you're just trying to be my friends. So the thing is that after the whole Christmas debacle, you know, I went home to Los Angeles, and this one night, this one horrible, horrible night, I found myself at this party in Malibu on this beach full of strangers. And the sun was coming up, and I was just drunk off my ass. And I remember looking around and thinking, you know what? Maybe the problem isn't Joey or Pacey or Jen, CJ, or Jack or Dawson.
It's David. Just kidding. Clip 13.
Maybe it's me.
Oh! Also, speaking of that party and Dawson, even though he was obviously in the middle of his own professional shit at the time, I feel like we could have gotten a scene of him, like, phoning someone to say he saw Audrey and he forgave her about the car house incident, so they should go easy on her when she came back.
I understand that they needed to do something that would signal, at least to the audience, that this was a pretty serious situation, like, out of the realm of just kind of normal college sophomore binge drinking behavior in response to a broken heart, which up to that point, it's like, all right, sure. Like, yeah, the meltdown at the show was embarrassing. She probably shouldn't have fucked CJ, but that's because he's CJ and it's not really to do with substance misuse.
Right.
But like, she drove a car through a building in the winter.
Yeah.
Over a snow carpet. Like, what a nightmare. This is threatening the integrity of the building. Like, they picked the wrong way to do this.
Yeah.
I think. And then they just continue to not really have a handle on how any human person would be spiraling. Like, we'll get to it in a minute, but is this an amends? At no point does she say she stopped drinking. Like, it's like they don't know anybody who's in recovery, which this is a Hollywood writer's room. You do know these people. Like, just think a few steps, if you'll forgive the use of that word, ahead. And like, how do you want this to actually resolve?
Right.
Because sometimes they're also playing it like, oh, Audrey. And it's like, but she drove into a building. And if the idea is that she is troubled and this is an ongoing arc, pick a tone. Not that one. No, not that one either.
Yeah. I can forgive a certain degree of like mushiness about this because she is supposed to be 19 or 20. Like, I don't expect her age to necessarily understand like what actions she needs to really take in order to get a handle on problem drinking, even if after you drive a car into a house, you're like, okay, well, this isn't great and it probably wouldn't have happened if I were sober.
Right. But it's also a pretty bog standard, like, I am embarrassed by my behavior.
Right.
I'm pretty sure it's my drinking. I will say and mean that I'm not going to do it anymore. And then the minute that becomes a little uncomfortable, I will return to it. Like, this is very normal.
Yes. Even sometimes people who are much older than this character think that they can get away with like having a few cheeky beers every now and then. Brad Pitt, who recently gave an interview where he said, oh, I'm only like kind of sober now, even though the last time I was using alcohol, I attacked my wife on a plane in front of our children, which is why they don't talk to me anymore. But I now have just like cut down. So great. Seems like you've got it all figured out. Sexagenarian.
Yeah, like, okay. Like, we don't have to get into like granular. It works if you work it stuff.
Right.
Like,
right.
You know, that's fine. The choice to have her drive into the house, and then sometimes it's wah wah, and other times it's like, oh, but you drove into a house. Like,
yes. Right.
How does Gail feel about this? Please pay Mary Margaret Humes and give her some lines in which she's like, well, actually, the insurance payout was quite handsome, and we blah, blah, blah. Like, oh, fine.
Right.
Dispose of this somehow. But
yes.
All the actors involved in this deserve much better than this extremely deeply inconsistent treatment of the lack of treatment.
Yeah.
And it will not end in this episode, so I should just shut up and let things happen.
Right. Before we do, the thing that bothers me is what you said before, which is like the yawing between like, oh, no, we are deeply concerned for Audrey, and like, oh, this is just another way Audrey is Audreying out. Roll your eyes, tee hee. Don't you think you better? Like, you know, that's the part that bugs me more, where it's like,
yeah,
everyone is not reacting the way I think they would.
If they're all also 19 or 20, it's like, okay, I can see them kind of getting up to the brink of like, you have issue. This is a disease. You need to get treatment.
Yes.
And not doing it because they're 19 and you don't necessarily know how to do that at that age. No one's talking to each other when they're not on screen. It's like that, oh, I guess we'll just stand around in a charger and wait for the dialogue to have us interact.
Right.
With this person who was there over the holidays and drove, like, what happened after that?
Right.
We only saw Doug and Pacey talking about it. Like, what? Are they just not discussing Audrey at all?
Yeah. There was the one moment where Jen was like, hey, are you okay? When she was like upstairs in the house that she just vandalized with a car.
Yeah, which that was another. And she's like, fuck off. I'm taking a nap. Like, oh, my God. She'd driven into the side of Barb's house. Holy shit.
But the other, I'm sorry, we will continue this scene, which is not over yet. But since they also had an opportunity to sort of like extend it by having Jack, the last person who had a drinking issue on this show, like say, you know, I understand how it is. I had a problem last season, too, as you might remember last year or whatever. And I got a handle on it. So if you want to find out what my tips and tricks were, like something. That he was like, had a drinking problem, was not a problem drinker. in the same way mm-hmm. we're supposed to think she is sometimes and other times not. Anyway, if we had gotten that call from Dawson being like, Audrey and I talked and I forgave her, someone maybe could have known to jump in before this gets pitiful. Here, clip 14.
I don't expect you to forgive me right away because I do realize how bad I've messed up. And, you know, I just, if you guys want to call me sometime, you know, just to say hi, that would be really cool because I really love you guys and I miss you. And I'm just really sorry.
What kind of shitty people are these also to just be like, well, that sounds like none of our business. Like you were, most of you, present mm-hmm. when she aerated the Leary house.
Yeah.
No one wants to call someone who knows her. Her mm-hmm. parents weren't contacted to pay for this.
Yeah. But these being the keen teens of Dawson's Creek, they let her start to walk away before they go give her their big hugs. So everything is forgiven for now. But the next day, we're in the hall outside of Emma's apartment. A bunch of rock chicks are waiting in a line that Audrey seems to know means bad news for her. When Emma answers the door to her, Audrey jokes about all the Courtney Love wannabes. It's like an Audrey convention. And as the other two Hell's Bells members look on, one of whom, by the way, in the light of day looks 45. Sorry, girl, but you do.
Yeah.
Emma says these girls are auditioning to be their lead singer because, yes, Hell's Bells had one, but she was getting drunk and fucking up on stage and then blew town and missed a bunch of rehearsals. Basically, all the stuff that typically gets lead singers fired from bands. Hell's Bells has a gig tomorrow opening for the band that's opening for a band that's kind of a big deal. And here's the question mark. To me, it sounded very obviously like Emma says Loudermilk, and that is the name of the band that we're about to see. And when we see their drum kit, it says Loudermilk on it. But on the Wikipedia, mm-hmm. it says they were in this episode as Loudermilk. So I don't know. They're known as Gosling now because apparently even though they had like basically the same membership, they totally changed their sound at some point in the 2000s. So I don't know what's going on with them, but we linked you to their Wikipedia in the show notes.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of early aughts band hair.
Oh, my God.
A whole lot.
Yeah,
a lot of tushy bit head. Ooh.
They are also playing at the Bent Elbow, which Audrey has to tell us is a famous place because it's not, in fact, real. Emma says this gig could be big for them, so they need a singer with talent, minus the trauma. Audrey acknowledges all her fuck-ups, but promises that she had an epiphany on the beach in Malibu, on the beach, not at promises, and realized her partying was costing her everything important to her, like her friends and this band, and if they give her another chance, she definitely will not let them down. Emma looks back at the other two, and the one who looks like she might be in her 20s gives a tiny nod, so Audrey's back in and tackles Emma back onto the couch in celebration. And then we're at the famous Bent Elbow, and Hell's Bells are doing a run-through, improbably attended by Loudermilk. Maybe Audrey's departure was good for the band creatively, because they apparently wrote a whole original while she was gone. Clip 15. Not bad. I think that's actually a pretty decent song, and she sounds good.
Yeah, she does.
Emma reminds them all to be back there at 8:15, and Audrey's getting a nice wholesome water when she is approached by a guy from one of the other openers. Has she heard of Satan's tampon? She has not. Well, never mind. If she likes to have fun, there's a party on the bus after the gig, which, like, yeah, I assume that's what buses are for, but cool.
Uh-huh.
And when we see Audrey again, she's on the bus looking sober and bored. the guy who invited her tries to make small talk, and she admits she is nervous about the gig because she's never performed sober before. He offers her a swig from the bottle of brown liquor in her hand, but she says she quit, which lasts as long as it takes the guy to pass it to the dude beside Audrey. Then she asks for a sip and then takes an unidentified pill from the Satan's tampon guy. Oh, Audrey, whom could have seen this coming?
Yeah.
And then it's time for Hell's Bells to play. The rest of the band take their positions, Emma watching from behind her kit as Audrey tosses back one last shot and rushes toward the stage to fuck it up, just like she swore she wouldn't. Clip 16.
What is up, Set Elbow? Who can turn the world on with a smile? Who can take a nothing day?
Yeah.
It's a rough one.
This is on Emma and the rest of them from here. Like, you can give her a song to try to equalize.
Mm-hmm. They continue to struggle through it. I mean, it is on Emma and the rest of the band, because I doubt that if they can play, none of them can sing, like, sing well enough to get through this, just to not have to start from zero with Audrey again.
Yeah.
When we return to the set, Audrey is tunelessly droning through Bad Times, the Hell's Bells original. On the instrumental, Audrey drops the mic on stage and leaps into the crowd, getting dizzy as they return her to stage, which is where she gets out one line and then collapses. And at least this time, the rest of the band stops playing, so Audrey can really hear it as the crowd boos her.
Mm-hmm.
And after the commercial, Louder Milk is on with their Louder Milk bass drum. Backstage, Emma brings Audrey a water, checks that she is okay, and then curtly states she's out of the band. Audrey whines that Emma can't kick her out. She had an epiphany on a beach in Malibu, and she knows she can do better. And obviously, Emma believes that speech less this time than she did last time she heard it. She's gonna get Audrey a cab to go sleep it off. And when we see Audrey after that, she is staggering into her empty dorm room, hurling herself toward the bed, though not hurling yet. After steadying herself for a second, she laboriously gets up and opens a dresser drawer, pulling out a fifth of something brown and taking a long sip. When she comes up for air, she gives the bottle a disgusted look, taking it into the bathroom and dumping the contents down the sink before letting the empty bottle smash on the floor and sprawling back onto her bed. And then Joey's getting back from that horrible, godforsaken shithole known as Worcester to her dorm room, smiling when she sees Audrey passed out in bed. When Joey crouches to pick Audrey's jacket up off the floor, she notices the broken bottle on the bathroom floor and panics, trying to shake Audrey awake and calling 911 when she can't. And that's the end of the episode. Uh-oh, not great.
No.
Let's close things up by naming our episode MVP. I hate to say it because he's such a shithead, but Hetson really made me laugh this episode. So I'm going to say him.
I'm going to go with Harley. At least she tried to move the ball instead of just like letting Joey bitch fruitlessly about stuff.
That's true. She did make things happen. Least valuable player. The Worcester, Massachusetts Chamber of Commerce. I literally was going to say that. All right.
But I will also say dishonorable mention to any other Hell's Bell besides Audrey. Like, you knew how this was going to go. And once you saw it going that way again, you should have just not let it continue.
Yep.
Speaking of letting it continue, next time on Again With This, Dawson channels his inner Todd, Jen and CJ play Cupid for Grams, and Joey and Eddie team up for the worst Thelma and Lewis remake ever conceived. It's hard for us to conceive that Pants Rises were ever that small, but they were, and the proof is in our visual aids. We do those for every episode of the Again With This podcast, and you can find them, along with the full archive of the episodes themselves, on our website, againwiththispodcast.com. I'm Elbow Bender Sarity Bunting. I'm on Blue Sky at Sarity Bunting. My co-host is Hard Seller Tara Ariano. She's on Blue Sky at Tara Ariano. And our producer, David T. Cole, is just really sorry. Talk to you next time.
Thanks for the recap.